On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Week by week now, genetic science is unlocking amazing secrets of life. It is also unlocking secrets of disease and death. Medical science can now look into your genetic code with a fair chance of forecasting your health future. The likelihood of certain cancers or Alzheimer's, the certainty of early death from Huntington's disease. What was a mystery can now be laid out like a map. But once we know, we have to live with that knowledge. The bliss and worry of ignorance is gone. Up next on Point, genetic testing telling us more and more about our health futures and living with what we learn from our DNA. Joining me first today from New York is Amy Harmon, reporter for the New York Times. She's been writing a series on the impact of genetic technology on American life. Her front page piece, Facing Life with a Lethal Gene, profiled a young woman who got tested for and diagnosed as having Huntington's disease at age 23. Amy Harmon, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And with us from New York is that young woman, Catherine Katie Moser. Katie's been living for the last couple of years with the knowledge that she will develop the difficult symptoms of Huntington's disease, probably in her late 30s. Huntington's is fatal. Katie's 25 now and a healthcare worker in New York City. Katie Moser, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
It was a big step that you took. Others in your family had had the chance and not taken it. What took you at age 23 to take the plunge and learn whether you would or would not get this disease with everything that comes in its wake, Katie?
I always talked about wanting the test since I was about 13. So when I was 23, I happened to be working at a facility with Huntington's disease, and I spoke to someone here, and he told me where I could go and get the test. So that's just, but it was always something that I wanted to know. I wanted to know if I was going to develop it, and I wanted to plan my life for it.
What does learning that it's in your genetic code, that it's on its way, what does it mean for you? At what age is what likely to happen, Katie?
With my family history, I think it'll probably be about 50. So I'm still have 25 more years until I'm really symptomatic. But, I've done some research into what my genetic mutation means, and it could be earlier than that. So I have a lot of plans for my life, so I'm trying to fit them all into a more compact time.
Right, we hear that. And what about your likely lifespan? Does the code lay that out for you? Do the doctor say, well, Katie, you're likely to live until or die at a particular age?
No, it's not yet that specific, because we don't know what else is in my genes that might have an effect on onset. But they say that from onset, it's approximately 20 years.
You know, Huntington's is a very clear case. They can look at the genetic lineup there and tell with great specificity and clarity. Many others not quite so clear, but a lot coming along in this way. Katie, what do you think made you have this attitude of wanting to know? Your mother did not want to know. She said, Amy quotes her in her piece, saying, you don't want to know stuff like that. You want to enjoy life. What's the difference in perspective that led you to want to know, as millions of others may one day or year soon know about their health futures? Why do you think you wanted to know?
I think I found it difficult to live with the uncertainty. And I found myself every time, like, say, I'd trip or I would drop something or I'd forget something, it would kind of be like, oh, it's the Huntington's disease.
Coming on.
Yeah, so I think, part of being tested, you hope to find out that, it's not in your future. But, I knew, I understood my risk.
Right. The results could have come back the other way and given you a clean slate knowing that it wouldn't be there, but they came back positive. You know it's sitting out there, but you wanted to prepare, as you say.
Yes.
Wow. Amy Harmon, you've done a lot of reporting on this. We've got a revolution in genetic science coming upon us now. It will also mean a revolution in how we have to think about our health and our health futures.
Do you see Katie Moser's attitude as one that's moving to the fore? Is society, individuals changing, becoming more ready to know what was very recently a pretty complete mystery to most people?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, as I was reporting the story, and really even more so after it came out, I've had a lot of conversations with friends and colleagues and sort of just random people who read it about, you know, this question, would you want to know? And it's just something that everybody weighs differently. It cuts across. I mean, different people have different attitudes. It cuts across age and gender and profession. And, you know, I mean, I used to think I could probably guess. So, you know, I used to think reporters like myself would want to know.
The reporters, after all.
Yeah, right. You know, we sort of were predisposed to want to know things. But that's, you know, that's not true. I mean, you know, some do and some don't. And so, you know, I think that, I mean, I do think that Katie's generation, growing up with, you know, it makes a difference having learned in high school or sort of having, knowing that genetics is sort of a part of their life in a way that it wasn't a part of, you know, even my education or, you know, people just a little bit older. Katie's, you know, she's 25 now. And so I think that there is, to some degree, some of the mystery or sort of fears and stigma that that were genetics and genetic disease was sort of shrouded in, is being lost. You know, or, you know, this generation is sort of saying, well, you know, we understand genetics. We know, first of all, that it's not, you know, it's not our fault. This is something we were born with. It's just something that's in us. You know, and so we want to face it and we want to deal with it. And you know, sort of a growing awareness that the ability to do so is out there. There's also more of an ability to do so. And there are more tests. There, you know, sort of the sequencing of the human genome and genetic research is coming forward with so many more options that, you know, that is one reason why I was really drawn to Katie's story, because I think it kind of gets to the heart of a dilemma that we may all soon be facing. You know, scientists are discovering genes that cause disease much faster than they're discovering the cures for the diseases. So, you know, pretty soon we're all going to have this choice. Do we want to know something about ourselves, something about our future, or what may be our future, whatever our genes predispose us to, even if it's something that we can't necessarily do anything about? And, you know, I think that's something that people are beginning just now to grapple with.
It's a big, tough one, and it's coming at all of us. Katie, what about your friends? When they learned that you had reached out to learn this, did they, most of them, say, I would do the same, or I'd never want to know? What kind of response do you get to the fact that you looked in the crystal ball?
I would say probably it's like a 50-50. I mean, people said that, you know, if they had something in their family, they would want to know. And then people said that they know that they have something in their family, but it's just not something that they want to deal with right now. All my friends were very supportive of my decision. And, you know, I know that it's a very personal decision, and I'm supportive of whatever decision that they make, because that's one of the most necessary aspects of genetic testing, is to have the support around you.
But of course,
you don't know what the results are going to be.
You don't know what they're going to be, but once you learn them, the impact is not only for yourself. We're going to look in this hour at issues of privacy, insurance coverage, and a lot more. But there's also, when you learn, loved ones learn as well. I mean, first of all, they have to take on the emotional, sometimes burden of knowing. In your case, something even more than that, the fact that you were positive meant, we know this from Amy's reporting, you've been candid with her, meant that your mother also was. She hadn't known. So you learning also, in a way, put the future in front of someone very close to you with tough consequences for your relationship there. It's not only for yourself when you learn on this front, in your case, is it?
No, but I mean, my relationship with my mother has been very difficult for a long time, and it's complicated. But I mean, she's been symptomatic for years, and you know, I tested, and I didn't tell anybody for, like, in that side of my family for months. But then the situation got a little more complicated, and it came to whether I should protect my mother or protect my young cousin.
And it gets more and more complicated. Amy Harmon, this is powerful information once we have it. Is our medical system ready for this? Are we, as you know, as humans ready for what's coming at us on the genetic science front?
Well, you know, I think that one issue is really how this information is presented to people when they get it. And sometimes, you know, sometimes you have a genetic counselor, and genetic counselors are trained to sort of, you know, try to explain everything to you in sort of a holistic way, and then, you know, sort of preferably before. I mean, Katie went through, you know, quite almost an ordeal to get tested, and you know, there are very good reasons for that. I mean, she can tell you about it, but the people at the Columbia Center where she got tested, you know, wanted to make sure that she would understand, that anyone who comes there would understand, you know, what it would mean, the burden of knowing. So, you know, you go through. The genetic counselor kind of lays that all out for you, and you sort of talk about, well, do you want to know how would it change your life if you knew? I mean, this is going to be different for every category of test.
Katie, let me ask you, when you went for the test, obviously you didn't know which way it was going to go. You hoped against hope because you had seen what you thought were symptoms in your mom, but you hoped for that clean bill of health. How did it feel when you didn't get it? Did you feel betrayed by fate?
I mean, it was shocking. Like, I knew it was a possibility, but it's not really what you're hoping for. So it was shocking, but, I mean, since then I've made some changes in my life that are more positive and, you know, trying to learn to take care of myself. So, and, I mean, I've used my information to try to help other people. You know, just there's a whole National Youth Alliance through the Huntington's Disease Society of America that are youths just like me who are struggling with the idea of testing, or who might have tested, or who just are somehow affected by Huntington's. And, you know, it's great to know that you're not alone in this, because growing up, it's a very lonely disease.
Mm. Katie, we salute your courage on this, and we appreciate your sticking with us here as we talk with scientists and medical people are looking at this frontier, because you've taken the plunge, and your outlook on what they've got to say is important to us. If you'll stand by for just a second in New York, I want to go to Washington, D.C. We're joined from Washington by Alan Guttmacher, a doctor and deputy director of the National Human Genome Research Institute at the National Institutes of Health. Alan Guttmacher, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's good to be with you, Tom.
I wish you'd pull back the curtain for us on where we stand now in genetic testing and where we're heading. What's the array of diseases and medical conditions that we can now either predict definitively or predict chances of, and where are we likely to go in the next 5 or 10 years on this rapidly advancing front?
Well, I think, Tom, you've hit perhaps the key descriptor right there, that it is rapidly advancing. Currently, we can test for hundreds of different genes, many of which, as is the case with Huntington's disease, if one has the genetic variation, you can be fairly certain that you will develop the disease. Mm. However, for many of those, that's not the case. There are tests which, as you described earlier, simply indicate something about one's risk for disease rather than certainty of getting it. But there are hundreds of those currently. Most of them are for so-called single-gene disorders, disorders that, like Huntington's disease, where there's a single gene involved. For diseases that tend to be somewhat more common, sometimes called complex disease because their etiology is a little bit more complex. It's not just genes. It's a combination of genes and environment. Mm-hmm. Things like heart disease, stroke, diabetes, we're not quite so far along. But even for those, we're developing tests that will say something about one's risk for developing the diseases.
So at the current point, what, colon, breast cancer? I've read you can look at your genetic makeup and see what your risk factors look like there. Alzheimer's, what else?
Well, particularly if you have a family history of any of those things. If someone has no particular family history, let us say, of colon cancer, it may not make sense for them to have a test which doesn't look at your overall risk for colon cancer, but simply looks at a few specific genes that we know confer a much increased risk for colon cancer. For people who have a family history where a number of people have had colon cancer, particularly perhaps if they develop it at an earlier than typical age for colon cancer, in those situations, testing can be done to look for specific changes. And you've given a number of those, but for the list is ever expanding. I think it's important to really underline what Amy Harmon mentioned earlier, is that we're at an age right now where we're able to find genes that cause disease much more quickly than we're able to cure the disease based on that knowledge. But that transition is happening. So we're in an era where not just are we able to test for more and more genes that may cause disease, but we're also in an era where we're beginning to use that understanding to make a difference in being able to treat and one day, we hope, even truly cure and even beyond that, prevent the disease from even occurring.
If you can predict and cure, you've got a great combination. When you predict or even more firmly forecast the onset of disease, that's pretty tough to live with. How wide do you think this kind of screening could go? Are we going to see genetic screening that can, as you say, move toward more common things? I mean, heart disease, stroke, diabetes, are those going to be on the genetic readout in the foreseeable future?
Yes, I think they will be. Certainly the foreseeable future for many people that are alive today will have that kind of testing sometime during their lives. Is that testing readily available today? No, because we don't understand enough yet about these genetic factors and exactly how they interact, very importantly, with non-genetic factors to cause disease. But as we learn those things, yes, within the relatively short period of time, it's going to become a very common part of everyone's health care.
Let me bring another voice in here. Caroline Lieber joins us from Bronxville in New York. She's director of the Human Genetics Program at Sarah Lawrence College, country's biggest graduate program in genetic counseling, where she teaches. She spent 18 years doing genetic counseling at hospitals in New York and New Jersey. Caroline Lieber, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Give us a sense of where we're headed here. You've dealt with lots of people already who have had the sort of genetic word put in front of them and had to deal with it. How are humans at handling this when, as Dr. Guttmacher says, very often there's no cure for what we're given a heads up on?
I think from my perspective, the piece that's the most important in this is to try to establish a communication between the people who are dealing with the information. So that there's an educational process on the level of the communication between the healthcare professional and the patient. So Dr. Guttmacher is talking, I think, in a bigger picture. If you look at it on the day-to-day and work in the genetic counseling world, what you're looking at is trying to make sure that those people who are impacted by this information have the educational background and the understanding of the genetics to make the decisions that are going to be the most appropriate for them.
But the first thing is just getting their heads around the fact that you're saying, here's a disease that's likely coming at you. How do you find people are in handling that? Does everyone want to know? Do some people deliberately not want to know? I mean, it seems like a big transition for us. We've lived, since time immemorial, not really knowing until disease hit us right up the side of the head.
Right, and we haven't had the opportunity to know that kind of information until recently. The last couple of decades has this been available, and even more recently with more kinds of conditions. It runs the gamut, Tom. You see people on both sides. You see people who do want to know, and you see people who feel that they don't want to know. In the case of looking at conditions like you both talked about cancers, colon cancer and breast cancer, if you look at those populations and you find people who are considered high risk, there are different ways of looking at that, because in those high-risk families where there might be testing that could say you're predisposed, within the colon cancer families, there's the opportunity for intervention that could allow people to be screened and possibly treated or cured through colonoscopy, or at least managed in a different way. You have a lot more options in that situation than you might in dealing with families with breast cancer, where there's surveillance, but there's not a specific thing you can do to manage the condition so that the colon cancer goes away.
Caroline Lieber, Dr. Guttmacher, and Katie Moser, please stand by. We've got a lot of listeners who want to join this conversation talking about genetic screening for our health futures. Tim's calling from Reigate, Vermont. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I want to express my empathy for Katie, having been in a family that had the fear of genetic inheritance of HD or Huntington's disease for about 30 years after my mother's death in 1969. But when my sister became ill in 1995, the test had become available, and my father was one of the ones who helped raise money along with Marjorie Guthrie, Woody Guthrie's widow, to find the marker.
Of course, Woody Guthrie died from Huntington's, famously.
Correct. Yes. Mm-hmm. My sister was tested, and completely baffling to us was that she came back negative for Huntington's, which my mom had been presumed to have had even as a result of the autopsy.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were suddenly in an awful new world where we were uncertain about what we were dealing with. And as it turned out, I did a lot of research, and my brother and I gave blood trying to figure out and narrow down what it could possibly be. And it was finally determined to be Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease.
So you went in looking for Huntington's and came out with a different disease, but also a very tough one.
Correct, and one that's exceedingly rare and, again, like Huntington's, incurable. And my brother and I were told after my sister was given her diagnosis that we were 50-50 heirs to this and that they had the results if we wanted to know them.
Did you both get the results?
My brother did not want to know them. I at first didn't want to know them, but then realized that some of the discussions with my sister's physicians indicated that some of the medications I was on for another condition might possibly have some ability to be ameliorative of some of the symptoms of CJD.
It sounds as though you eventually dove in. What was your brother's fate? What's your own?
My brother died a couple of years after my sister in 1997 of Creutzfeldt-Jakob, so I'm one of the three kids in the family left, and I came out on the better end of that particular genetic lottery.
So you took the test and it said you're clean. This is not a problem for you.
Correct.
Wow, we see the complicated calculus we get into the middle of here. Why do you think your brother didn't want to know and you did, Tim?
I think that my brother always expected that this is the way he was going to die because he might be one who was described as seeing the world where the glass is three quarters empty as opposed to half full. And given his pessimistic take on life, I think he expected this was the way he was going to go, and he didn't want to have it confirmed 100%. We talked about it, that if you have a 50-50 chance of knowing that you're going to die by being hit by a bus tomorrow, do you want to know that, or do you want to know that 100%? And my feeling was, like his initially, that I didn't want to know, that I prefer living with the 50-50 chances. But I made my judgment based on what I might be able to do in helping
right.
my sister and her kids and perhaps my brother and myself.
And you came out lucky. Katie Moser in New York. Here's Tim who dove in when the stakes were just as high. He was lucky. His brother wasn't. You must hear a lot of familiar thought dynamic that's gone on in Tim's family, Katie.
Yes. I mean, in my family and... I mean, again, in the other youths in the National Youth Alliance, there's a lot of people who, you know, went to be tested and, you know, it came back positive. And, you know, I mean, for Tim and everybody, you know, it's very good to know that, you know, it's not in your future. But, I mean, then people kind of puzzle with the, you know, like I have the why me,
mm-hmm.
but then some people will have the, well, why not me?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Caroline Lieber, have you seen that? And Tim, thanks very much for your call in Vermont. Caroline?
Yes, very much. There are both of those. So for people who test and end up not carrying the gene, there's almost a survivor guilt about that and trying to understand why is it that I was not the one selected to carry this gene and someone else was. The other point that Tim made that I think is important is the idea of people undertaking genetic testing with the idea of helping other family members, and that is really critical and often seen in the people who come in for genetic counseling and then decisions about genetic testing.
Helping them in what way? To know that they'll be alive and around, or to try to know that, or to just by understanding their own health, there are very often genetic implications for relatives?
I think it's both. I think that there are combinations there. If there's a way in which you have my DNA in this research mix, or there's some sort of, as Tim was talking about, the possibility of medications, if you know what my particular situation is, are there ways in which you can use that data to help develop medications?
Mm.
It's all of those pieces.
Alan Guttmacher, you've worked a lot with genetics and cancer, pediatric medicine in Vermont earlier. I mean, what is your sense? Are human beings wired to handle this information? Or are we going to have to get rewired because science is going to hand it to us whether we're wired for it or not?
Well, I think, of course, we've all been dealing with lots of information that's had huge impact upon our health and other aspects of our lives for generations. But there is something different about this type of information. As you were just talking about, for instance, the fact that genetic information says something not just about oneself, but about your biological relatives by definition. It has a different character for a number of reasons, and we really need to figure out together as a society how we're going to deal with this information. I think one of the lessons that those of us in medicine and other parts of healthcare have already found is that this is really yet one more reason to get away from a paternalistic view of healthcare where the doctor sort of tells someone what to do, et cetera. Amy Harmon's experience talking with friends, reporters, other people about, gee, would you want to know or not, is the same thing that we health professionals see. No matter how well you know someone, it's very difficult to predict whether they really want to know a piece of information about themselves or not. So we need to come up with ways of allowing people to make truly informed choices about having this kind of testing, about gaining this kind of information about themselves, and not just assuming that everyone is going to want to know everything and coming up with some kind of healthcare system that insists they know even if they don't want to.
Really into existential issues. Caroline Lieber, do you imagine coming down the pike with this science, a society in which we essentially all walk around with a map of our health future in our mind, or even, you know, sort of, I don't know, a tattooed on our shoulder here? What will that mean for the way people interact, for who marries whom, and how we look at potential long-term colleagues? I mean,
it's pretty scary to think about. And I know that Dr. Guttmacher and I have talked about this in the past, that there's a feeling that the technology itself is racing ahead and that there's no parallel discussion of what this technology means with regard to society as a whole. So there needs to be, from my perspective, a kind of stepping back and an opportunity for people to begin to understand what this technology means. On the far end of the spectrum, that's what genetic counseling really is. It's that process of saying, all right, in this particular situation with this particular family, if you were to test, what does it mean to test positive? What does it mean to test negative? If you test positive, what does it mean for the other people in the family? So as much as you can, you're trying to understand the implications of the testing for that particular family unit. And what's changing is this possibility of doing this on a more population-based level down the road. And I think that there needs to be a lot of discussion, communication, to better understand on the level of society what some of these implications are.
Let's go to Clarksville, Tennessee, and Diane. Hi, Diane, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to comment to Katie. I read the article in the New York Times, and it was just incredibly heartbreaking. But I have to say that I need to commend her on her bravery in doing so, and also the bravery of her friends who have said that they would take care of her when she starts to get sick.
That's a big commitment, but that's the kind of thing people have to deal with once they know.
Yeah, and I guess the thing that struck me about the article was that I have ALS in my family and Lou Gehrig's disease, and I think to myself, if I knew I was going to get it, I would immediately want to realign my priorities and kind of live life differently. But maybe that's a lesson. Maybe we should all be living like that anyway.
But what does that mean, that if you knew it, you would want to realign? Does that mean are you so sloppy in your priorities now? Are we all, Diane, thinking that we're going to have, the media, whatever it is, 75 or 80 years ahead of us?
Well, maybe we put things off because we think we're going to last forever, and we don't get around to all the things we say we're going to do, like write a book and, scale a mountain or whatever. It doesn't have to be extraordinary, but, I think it's something to look at, that when faced with something like this, Katie has decided what she wants to fit into her life, and I really just commend her for her bravery.
Diane, thank you for that. Katie, very practically, has it really changed your outlook? I mean, you still go to work every day. You're not off climbing Mount Everest. Not all of us can just take off and do that, or even if we wanted to. How would you describe the way it's changed your day-to-day life? Has it?
First, thank you for the comments, Dan. I work at Terrence Cardinal Cook Healthcare Center in Manhattan, and we're a 700-bed facility, but we have a 50-bed Huntington's unit. And so, at first, coming to work was a little like difficult. I didn't, you know, go down to the unit right away.
Because you can see the deterioration of capacity right in front of you there of people on the path that, further down the path you're on.
Yes. I mean, it was just, it was a reminder. But then I realized in my family growing up, it wasn't something we talked about. It was something we hid. So it was scary. But on the unit, I mean, there's patients that are caring and loving, patients that are in love, patients that, you know, want to talk to you, patients that are, they're funny, they tell jokes. And I realized it's not, Huntington's does not make you angry and say mean things. Like, it just kind of, I think it kind of just makes you more of who you are. So, I mean, I kind of, in a way, I mean, embraced it. I tell the kids in my family that it's just, it's going to be part of me growing old. For me and in my genes, like, it's just going to be part of my natural aging progression, right. Unless, of course, the doctors find a cure.
And we all hope for that, but it means bringing a different kind of sort of cosmic maturity to our understanding of life. If ripped away from us is the notion, I think most people walk around with a kind of best case notion in their mind. I will live to the average and maybe more, you know, 80 years or maybe more. Let's get a call from Eric in Mystic, Connecticut. Eric, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You moved the conversation in the direction of my question and concern, and I think Dr. Guttmacher said about what will we do when we're on with all of this information and how will society handle it. And I'm reminded of that movie Gattaca with Uma Thurman and Ethan Hawke several years ago, where there was almost like a class system of people with perfect genetic makeup and those who weren't. They were allowed to have certain types of jobs and the other class wasn't. And I'm just wondering if your scientific community has thought about the ramifications of this advancing technology, and have you started maybe lobbying Congress to be ahead of it, to maybe start passing legislation so there won't be, you know, insurance discrimination, job discrimination, things like that.
Right, Eric, you raise a huge, important continent. Alan Guttmacher began to walk us in there, some of the policy implications of knowing. I think right now before Congress is this Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act that would, force insurers to insure people even if they know something about their genetic future.
Yeah, Tom, there's actually been a version of this act before the Congress for more or less every session in the last 10 years or more.
And never passed.
Well, it's passed the Senate the last two sessions unanimously, I believe 95-0, then 98-0. In this session, it's there have been hearings held in both the House and Senate. It's been passed in committees in each. It's now to the point in the House where the House Rules Committee needs to pull together varying versions because different versions were passed in the different committees. And then the House and Senate will need to get together on it. The president has already several times noted that he would pass this legislation were it to get to his desk.
But, Alan, let's make clear why this matters. Currently, if you get genetic testing and you find that something is looming out there, insurance companies can legally just deny you coverage for the rest of your life, if I've got that right.
It depends where in what state you live. There are over 40 states that have some kind of law limiting health insurers and employers' access to and use of your genetic information. The idea behind federal legislation is that, particularly since, as we've talked about during this program, much of this is information about your future, not your present.
Mm-hmm.
Since people move during their lives these days in the U.S., often from one state to another, change insurers, et cetera, that there's reason to think that national protection is the thing that would really make a difference to people. So I think for the first time ever in the Congress, it's very close to passage. It hasn't happened yet. There are details to be ironed out among the various versions, et cetera. But I think there's a good chance there will be such legislation. And you're right, without such protection, then there's both the real and perhaps even more importantly, the perceived concerns, fears that people have about being discriminated against in terms of being able to obtain health insurance, the cost of their health insurance, in terms of employment discrimination, having an employer refuse to hire you because of your genetic risk for future disease, things you don't have now, but just something that you might develop in the future.
Caroline Lieber, what about this sort of dystopia picture that our caller Eric fears out there? I mean, we're already doing an awful lot of prenatal screening. Many of those pregnancies don't go to term if people are really disturbed by what they see there. But can you imagine a time where we're all sort of so genetically transparent that there's a new kind of discrimination based upon who's got a likely full lifespan in front of them and who does not, Caroline?
I don't at this point see it that way. I from my perspective, again, it goes back to this thing that I keep saying, which is about education. And within the genetic counseling process, that's what we try to do, is to put in perspective. You talked about the prenatal testing. You want to put into perspective for people what it means to have this testing, what it means if the testing is positive or negative, and then for the family to make an informed decision about whether they want it or not. Not that we're trying to say everybody should do this, and that what we're trying to do from there is to eliminate people who don't fit into some category of what we decide is either perfect or normal or whatever you want to look at. That's a very frightening thought to me.
We're already reading about that. I'm reading here people with Down syndrome. Amy Harmon's writing, worried that they may be more and more lonely, that there'll be so few of them, you know, there'll be no one to congregate with there. Or
that there will be that services for people who have needs that are specific to a particular condition, that those specific needs might be taken away because there's not enough people with that condition.
Right. Or I read about another mother who got an all clear on Down syndrome. Then her child was born with hearing problems. She was upset because she said, well, why didn't you tell me that the child would have hearing problems? I mean, the expectations for transparency and risk avoidance seem to a dynamic, Caroline, that could push those very high.
Well, and now there are so many different things that can be tested for that the whole educational component of this becomes really important. And I think what happens is, in practice, it's easy. Again, I come back to this prenatal idea. It's easy to say, all right, well, there's a lot of information that we can test for. Here's a booklet. Go read it and then decide if you want the test or not, without anybody sitting down and saying, what are the implications of this testing, so that you're making a decision that truly involves understanding the pros and cons of the testing. And so people end up having testing without necessarily knowing what that testing was, and then the testing comes back positive or indicating that there might be an increased risk for a problem, and people become panicky about what does this mean.
Yeah.
They don't have a full understanding of the implications and what are the next steps. I mean, it's an educational process. And from my perspective, again, I think this is the piece where it's very difficult because the technology has moved way ahead and we're kind of behind the eight ball on that educational piece.
Not just as individuals, but as a society, even philosophically, how to keep up with this. Let's take a call from Springfield, Massachusetts. Angela, you're on the air.
Yeah, I think for the most part you've been addressing some of my comments, but specifically I'd like the panel to discuss the mandatory newborn screening of diseases such as cystic fibrosis and how that really impacts this whole discussion also.
There's a lot going on there, Angela. Thanks for that. Caroline, remind us of that. People who haven't had kids lately may not know. There's an awful lot of testing that is now required in some states at birth.
In most states, there are some conditions that are tested for at birth. And it's not exactly the same complement of tests in every state. In New York State, there are now 44 tests that can be screened for. And often what happens is, people will go into the hospital, they'll be in labor, they'll sign forms, they sign a form that says, go ahead and you can do this kind of testing on my child.
Yep.
But they don't understand exactly what the tests are. They're uninformed, and it's not really their fault.
So what are the implications if it comes back, okay, your child is positive for X, Y, or Z, so what?
Well, so what is that there's additional testing that may be needed to better understand, is this a false positive or is this a true positive? And the processing of that information does take time. And one of the things that we're learning is that there are conditions that now can be screened for that we don't understand exactly what the natural history of those conditions is because they're so rare. So the implication of that is that somebody can be identified as carrying one of these conditions, not showing symptoms, and we don't know exactly how to follow them within the system so they become medicalized, but they're not sick.
But they're walking out of that hospital with a big bag of information they wouldn't have had before.
Yes.
What to do with it. Carrie's calling from Concord, Massachusetts. Hi, Carrie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Yeah. What do you know, Carrie?
Hello. I'm having trouble hearing you.
We hear you loud and clear. What do you know there, Carrie?
Well, I have a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis, and I'm very healthy, and I have two children. And I know there's no genetic test for MS now, but there might be. I know it's a bunch of genes. It's not just one. Right, right. But I don't think I would want my boys to know.
Why?
Well, I see some people who have new diagnoses of MS, and they say things like, well, I know that I'll be disabled in 10 years.
So what's the point of getting out of bed or going to school or getting good grades?
I wouldn't want my children to think of themselves as having 8 years left before they're disabled, 4 years left. I certainly wouldn't want their insurance companies to think of them as going to be disabled, and I wouldn't want their potential spouses or their employers to think of them that way.
Katie Moser, you've gone down this road. What do you say to Carrie? She's thinking about her sons.
It's a personal decision.
Mm-hmm.
But I told my job, again, I work at a facility that has Huntington's, and I actually found them very supportive because they know that it's not going to happen anytime soon.
But they're in the healthcare business. They're predisposed to be supportive. If you had two boys and, something was sitting out there as a possibility, they were young, would you want them to know, or would you be afraid it would sort of shut down their engagement with the years of life they have in front of them?
I think, me personally, I would talk to them about it. Mm-hmm. I would educate them. There's always the option to live as if you're positive, just always being aware and, taking on the healthier lifestyle. Getting onto vitamins or anything that might help. So, I just would keep the lines of communication open.
Alan Guttmacher, what about your concern on this dystopia front where if we all know so much, we sort of begin to change our life plans? The way things are now, you can have some terrible health affliction waiting for you, but people don't know. They assume the best. They go like gangbusters at whatever they're doing. They might win a new job or an election and drop dead the next day. But if they knew in advance they were going to drop dead on the day, they never would have given it the shot. Does it change human ambition, our sense of how to pursue life, to have this knowledge?
Well, the old truism that knowledge is power is certainly true here. And it does have power. It has power to influence our lives in all kinds of ways, some of which we can imagine scenarios that would make our lives less fulfilling, less happy, less productive than they might be otherwise. And we can also imagine scenarios where they might be more so. And this is where I think it really gets to the point in our society anyway, the belief that the individual should be making decisions about this kind of information and whether they want to have it. And then once they've made the decision, construct their own way of dealing with it. But I think we also need to come up with societal ways that people, when they're making these decisions, are really informed about some of the implications. Earlier, Amy Harmon had talked about some of the many steps in the process that Katie needed to go through before she got testing for the Huntington's disease gene. And that testing process is particularly arduous because of the distinctive, if not unique, nature of Huntington's disease and genetic testing for it. And that long process was one that really came about by researchers, scientists, healthcare providers, and particularly families with Huntington disease working together to think, gee, what are the appropriate steps to really have informed decision-making about whether or not to have the test? And I would think that informed piece is particularly important. I think the other thing that's important is we talk about everything being genetic on this show, et cetera. Genes have a role in almost every human disease. But just because we understand the genes better than we ever did before doesn't actually make them more important. Non-genetic factors, social factors, cultural factors, diet, exercise, all those other things have just as much impact on our health, even in the age of genomics, as they ever had before.
So don't lose track of those basics, but we're suddenly tracking a whole lot more on top of that. And you've all helped us see what's coming in such a vivid way. We're very grateful. Alan Guttmacher at the National Institutes of Health. Alan, thank you for being here this hour.
My pleasure, Tom.
And Caroline Lieber at Sarah Lawrence College. Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Katie Moser, you've been so generous. We're very grateful to you. We wish you the best of luck. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.